thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.
This is the Fighter Pilot Podcast, episode 50. This week, we will discuss the Vietnam-era fighter that enjoyed a 19-3 kill ratio, best for its time, and also ushered in the age of air-to-air missiles. We will be talking with retired Navy Commander Jerry Turkey Tucker.
The F-8 was the last of the gunfighters. Now, nothing could beat the F-8. And I know that because I flew all the others. If I had a fight that I had to go where my life was on the line, I would be there by myself, fully loaded with 20 millimeter in an F-8.
Welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet radio show that explores the fascinating world of air combat, the aircraft, the weapon systems, and most importantly, the people. Now, here are your hosts, retired U.S. Navy fighter pilots Vincent Aiello and Brian Sinclair.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, episode 50. I'm Sunshine. And before we talk Turkey, or with Turkey, on the F-8 Crusader, Jello, welcome back. You've had a busy couple weeks.
Hey, Sunshine. Yeah, it's good to be back. How are you?
Doing well, man. How about you? What's been going on?
Well, it's been a busy month here in the Aiello household, Sunshine. As many of our listeners know, we've had a lot going on. One is that my oldest son, Slater, who often helps with the show, he graduated high school recently, and we had some family visiting for that. And a couple days later, my wife took him and his girlfriend and my middle son off to Italy, which is where they are now.
Wow.
And my wife and I celebrated our 21st wedding anniversary recently.
She still likes you?
She's still here. And well, she's in Italy, so I don't know. Maybe I should be concerned.
Good point.
But anyway, yep. And as I think most of the listeners know, on June 9th, my 93-year-old World War II veteran father passed away. We talked about him on episode 49. And at the time, his health was failing. And he's gone. And, you know, we've had to deal with that. And it's never easy losing a loved one. Do you have both of your parents, Sunshine?
Both parents, yes.
Okay, well, you know, it's difficult. Fortunately, it was no surprise. His health was failing. Let's see, you and I think, recorded episode 49, the fill for it. I want to say the Tuesday after Memorial Day, if I remember correctly.
Correct, absolutely.
Well, that Wednesday, the next day, I traveled up to Los Angeles from San Diego, where we live, and visited with my sister, who was helping with my father. That night, I started a five-day airline rotation. And on Sunday, my sister called me to say that my dad had slipped out of his chair, and she didn't have the strength to pick him up.
Oh,
so she had to call 911. So he ended up in the hospital that night, and they released him on hospice. And actually, that was on Saturday night. They released him on Sunday, June 2nd. And he spent a week in his own home, thankfully, in a hospital bed. And he kept kind of slipping further away. They put him on a tube and oxygen and everything. And Sunday night, June 9th, he was gone. And, you know, it was sad, but at least it was no surprise. And he led a full, very full life. We found in some paperwork, he never really talked much about the war like a lot of veterans don't.
Okay.
But once he was gone and I began helping my sister go through his effects, we found a letter he had written for some other purpose, but it talked about the fact that he served in Patton's Third Army and was in the Battle of the Bulge, which I thought I'd heard, but yeah, I never had any proof, so I was always a little hesitant to mention that. But yeah, he was there. He earned, I guess, 3 battle stars, they called it. I'm not quite sure what he did, but he was a, he was a combat engineer. So yeah, he had some interesting stories. In fact, I have some sound bites of him that I was thinking might be fun to stitch together and maybe make as a bonus or let our listeners check out at some point.
That's a great idea. Absolutely. Well, so yeah. He lived a full life, and fortunately, you and your family, entire family, had a chance to say goodbye, right?
Yes, we all did, pretty much. And so, you know, it was, like I said, it was tough, but I was just blown away by the support of our listeners, the outpouring on Facebook and emails, anywhere, social media-wise, that people who had heard about it, they were very gracious with their words of encouragement, including on Patreon and elsewhere, where people said, hey, take all the time you need. We're here. Don't worry about the show. And so thanks to you, by the way, Sunshine, for the intermission episode on June 12th. And, you know, people were just very gracious. Hey, family first, which, of course, you would expect. But when you have a show, you want to keep the show going. The show must go on, as they say in showbiz. Mm-hmm. And so here we are. But I'll tell you, having a chance to kind of take a step back from the podcast, you really get a glimpse of how busy it is. And the one thing that I did was I took a step back and I said, it's kind of nice to have emails to read and people to write back quickly and say, hey, I appreciate your support. We'll be back soon. But I think in general, getting to the announcements part of the show here, I think what I'd like to do, at least over the summer, is kind of throttle back the show a little bit. I've likened it to sprinting a marathon. 3 episodes a month is doable, but it was mm-hmm. keeping me really busy. And I think what we'll do going forward, beginning on this episode, is we'll air it on a Monday, and then we'll go every other Monday. And on the in-between Mondays, maybe we can release a behind the scenes, or once we get your deep dive stuff figured out, and I know we're working on that, mm-hmm. we can maybe release those on the other Monday as well. But
okay.
I just think it's a good time to reflect on how busy this is and just maybe release a little slower, at least through the summer while the kids are off. And maybe in the fall, we can pick back up if we feel that's the right thing to do at that time.
Sounds like a great idea. Hey, also thinking of our intermission episode. So I really felt that it was folks being subjected to my meandering answers to various questions via aircrew interview. So I appreciate the patience there. But, you know, why not for this episode, why don't we just skip the questions and go straight into the interview?
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, we still have a handful we need to get through, but we could maybe still, as we've talked about before, get together someday and do a Facebook Live. Possibly the two of us, or maybe we can get a previous guest or someone else. And if nothing else, maybe on the next episode, we can get caught up. But that sounds like a good plan to me. So, well, what do we have in store for the interview this week, Sunshine?
Well, Jello, this interview was actually very opportunistic. And what I mean by that is I met this guy through just another good friend of the family. He's a local guy. He and I met up in my kitchen. So sorry for the echoes there. But he's very unassuming. So you meet this guy out in public, just the nicest guy. I'll talk to anybody. You have no idea of the rich depth of history that he has with naval aviation. So hopefully the audience will enjoy it.
For sure. Now, I got a sneak peek at the interview already and had a chance to listen. He's got a bunch of great stories. It's amazing everything that he's done. But without further ado, why don't we let Turkey speak for himself?
Perfect. Today, I have the honor of having with me Jerry Turkey Tucker, retired naval officer, and has got quite an amount of stories. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good today. Thanks for having me with you.
Absolutely. Today we're going to focus on, and I've known you've flown many airframes, and we've got a lot of stories for each of those airframes, I'm sure. But today we're going to focus on the F-8.
Okay.
So, but first, let's start with your background, Jerry. So can you tell the audience a little about yourself?
Well, I'm retired from the Navy in 1988 after a fun career. Started right out of college, went right to flight training, and wound up starting in the F-8 was the first airplane that I flew.
Okay.
Before that, I did fly what a thing called NARMED, where we flew two-thirds Naval Academy kids.
And, thank you.
And a few NROTC people in the T-34
in
Corpus Christi.
Was that the T-34B?
Yes. We didn't have C's. Hadn't been invented yet.
Okay. You just dated yourself.
Had to rub that in, didn't you? Yes, we flew T-34Bs. It was a bunch of guys that just got their wings, and they sent us down there to build a little time and wait for classes to start. So we had every kind of background known to man down there. But I stayed there for the summer, and that was the summer they landed on the moon. So I was there when that happened, so we were all together watching. Oh, it was huge. That was really magic. Then I went to Miramar into VF-124, which was the FRS, or the Fleet Replacement School, or service.
Did you guys call it the RAG back then?
The RAG, yes.
Okay,
we call it the RAG.
Placement Air Group, gotcha.
And that was at Miramar in the F-8, where they were flying two models there, the F-8H and the F-8J. Mostly H's then. A big difference was the J had what they call a boundary layer controls, allowed you to slow down coming aboard the boat. The H was faster. It came aboard about a 145 indicator.
Okay.
We got it down to 120 or so in the J. And from there, I made two combat cruises.
Okay.
On the Hancock.
Okay. The Hancock in Vietnam?
In Vietnam, yes. Okay. Yeah, combat over there. And we'll talk a little bit about that, I'm sure, a little bit later.
Yeah, what squadrons were you in when you deployed?
At that time, I went from the RAG to VF-211 at Miramar.
The Checkmates, is that right?
That's correct.
Awesome.
And then I had another tour a little later, and then I came back to the F-8, and then I went into VF-191. Satan's Kittens.
Okay, so hold on. Before we get into Satan's Kittens, though, okay. Back as a checkmate, I think it was around May 22nd, just a little before I was born, in 1972, I think you had quite an epic experience, didn't you?
Yes, they had really opened up north again. It had a lot of bombing halts and a lot of starts and stops up there, but they'd opened it up again in 72.
Okay.
And I was flying as CAP for a strike group going in. As
so
flight
combat
leader.
Combat Air Patrol?
Combat Air Patrol,
CAP. Okay.
Yes. On a strike group going in the Hourglass area, which is about halfway up North Vietnam. It's an area where the coastline goes out and two rivers come in and they come together and it looks like an hourglass in there. And that's what we always use that as a navigational point where we knew where it was. You could call the hourglass, you knew where it was.
Okay.
We were just south of the hourglass. The strike was over. We escorted them out, and it's, those don't take near as long as they schedule for. So we always checked in. The fighters checked in with Red Crown, which was the controlling agency.
Okay. Navy-based controlling agency.
Navy-based controlling agency that handled most of any vectoring or anything. It kept track of all the aviation traffic in North Vietnam. And let them know that we had a couple of F-8s that, we had four Sidewinders, two apiece, and 200 rounds of 20 Mike, which is the gun. It wasn't Gatling. We had four weapons on the airplane, four 20-millimeter cannons, two on each side. And we only carried two Sidewinders. Too much drag on the two mount on each side, so we just carried one on each side.
I see. Okay. Parasite drag. Gotcha.
Yeah. And we were, when we got there, we heard that... there were MiGs flying, coming south from Hanoi. They had vectored two Phantoms that had checked in before us that were based on the Midway after the MiG. And on the vector, on the way to the MiG, they lost sight of each other and set up a rendezvous circle over North Vietnam trying to find each other while the MiG continued south. About the second time around the rendezvous circle, point two, and listen, the other guy still looking for his flight leader, I got a little upset and told Red Crown that, you got two F-8s out here. I can see my wingman. Do you think it's about time they made a change?
A little sarcasm on the tactical radio?
I did it as calmly and nicely as I could.
Yep.
But the controller agreed with me, vectored... the two Phantoms, feet wet, which is off the vector, and vectored us in.
Okay, so feet wet being they're back over the ocean.
Yeah, they vectored them back out over the ocean off of their vector.
So you're too slow, you're out, and Jerry's in with the...
If you can't find your wingman, pretty safe bet you're not going to see a MiG either. So I was flying with a guy named Frank Bachman, Lieutenant Commander Frank Bachman. I was a lieutenant at the time. We got to the area where it was... so he was supposed to be, and we couldn't see him. We didn't find him. And we were starting to take up ground fire. He's not here. And so as we turned out, I caught a glint about 15 miles north. It was just a glint off the windscreen. I had pretty good eyes in those days. And
15-mile
glint.
Acquisition, visual acquisition.
Well, you can see a glint from 20 to 25 miles. It's the sun off the windscreen.
Yeah.
And... I padlocked it. There was a black dot. It was just not much.
Padlock being you.
Padlock means
eyes
you look
it.
At it. I'm not going to blink. I'm not going to look away. I took the lead.
Okay.
Frank never questioned it. He said, "You got it." And I just kept my eyes on this dot, hoping against all hope it wasn't a floater in my eye. And as it turned out...
Which I've had.
Yeah, we all have had that or spot on the canopy. But it wasn't. And we turned in, I offset. Frank, just as a great wingman, just as he was as a great leader, he offset to give me support. We go into what they call combat spread,
okay,
where he goes out about a half a mile and up, 1,000, 2,000 feet, matching my speed so that he stays there and flies position there. And I just took the lead and saw the guy coming south, saw that it was a MiG-17. As I rolled in, I just was starting to get a growl meaning the sound this Sidewinder gives you that comes through our headset. And it's actually attached right to the Sidewinder that you selected. And when you start to get the growl, that means it's picking up infrared energy. And that's what is the guidance system for the Sidewinders. We had AIM-9Ds at that time.
Okay.
And I was just getting ready to, waiting for the heart of the envelope as I came in. He was going south at the speed of heat, just as fast as he could go, probably about 2,500, 3,000 feet.
And where are you roughly?
I'm high to the east, turning in on him. I know you can't see my hand.
No,
up here,
I was going to say, I wish this were a TV episode.
You
right
can see my hands right there, hands, pulling in, and my hands even in Buffett, pulling around, trying to get in the heart of the envelope, which is a cone that you have the highest probability of killing with a Sidewinder in.
Okay.
And like I said, I was just at the edge of that when I was getting a small bit of a growl from the Sidewinder, a little bounce because of the scan pattern of it. And I knew I was just about there. And all of a sudden, the airplane just nosed into the canopy, the jungle canopy,
okay,
and a parachute appeared.
He bailed out before
he jumped out. He just jumped out. And we made two passes by him. Now, he was hurt, but you could see his head was following us, but he never raised his arms. At the speed he was going and in that ejection, I'm fairly certain he dislocated his shoulders or something.
Flail
he hurt
injuries.
His arms, yeah, flail
yeah,
injuries.
Okay.
But you could see his head was following us as we went by.
So he was awake and he was watching.
Yeah, he was watching us.
So how close do you think you passed to his parachute canopy?
Oh, I was a couple hundred feet. When I went by.
Yeah.
But I kept the speed up because you never know what's going to happen, you know. But it was, 200 to 300 feet.
Okay.
Close enough where I could see his head was moving.
That's true. Good point. Okay.
But not much more than that. There was not a lot of detail I could get out of it. But you could see the helmet. And we made two passes.
Okay.
And then we started picking up some ground fire. We saw some tracers coming from the canopy. And he still was going down slowly. So we left.
So, Jerry, you're a MiG killer.
Well... yeah, some would say that, but I make scarer, I think, is a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah. Holy cow. So, and I mean, I know we have our flow that we usually follow here for the listeners at home, but that's just such an exciting story, and I'm just giddy like a schoolgirl to hear it. So I thought we'd throw it into the beginning.
Well,
so,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think our listeners have already heard about the AIM-9s. They understand the growl, which is great. So thank you for that depiction there. And you're doing a high to low shot, if you will.
Yes. So. And you don't have as much opportunity that, but he was low. That's why they do that. So that he has to look down at the earth because you get a lot of return from even the jungle canopy. You get some sidewinder
return.
Yeah. But the engine at full power on a MiG-17 was enough to it's shown through, let's put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. The good old Fresca. Huh?
Yeah.
Fresco. So, let's get back on track.
Sure.
But that was a great rabbit hole, if you will. So we got our F-8 story. We talked about the shoot down, the MiG killer. And I guess we'll get into it later, but the F-8 was pretty formidable in the North Vietnamese's eyes, correct?
Yeah, they didn't like to fly against us. That was the only MiG we saw in two cruises. Where the Phantom, now this is when Randy Cunningham was getting his five MiGs and that.
Right.
They would fly against the Phantoms because they weren't as, trying to be kind.
It's okay. Was the fat kid?
Yeah, they were kind of grapes. I mean, they didn't.
Okay, yeah.
A lot of their background, before Top Gun came into existence, they were interceptor pilots. They were not trained, not all of them, but the vast majority of them, especially a lot of the leadership in the group, they were intercept pilots. And they weren't as aggressive in combat, air-to-air combat, as we were. Now, that's all we did in the Crusader community, FA community, was air-to-air was our primary role. They had an air-to-ground role as well. And they had air-to-air girl. They had no guns.
Yeah.
Which was not their fault. That's just the people in D.C. decided that that was more important to have sidewinders and standoff. It was a standoff air-to-air type airplane.
Understood. So the F-8 guys are more of the night fight in the phone booth.
That's exactly right.
And
that's
the F-4 guys are the high, fast intercept, right. Straight lines.
BVR, okay. Or beyond visual range.
Perfect.
Shooting.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly right. Okay, yeah. So, and we'll definitely come back to the F-8. Okay. So F-8, are there a couple other platforms that you've flown in the Navy?
Well, yeah, I flew a few. I started in the F-8. Then when I left the first squadron, I went to a group called the Blue Angels and flew the Phantom there. I was in the last year of Phantoms. Didn't have a great year there. And I had a great year, but the team didn't. They lost 6 airplanes that year.
Oh, and how many air crew?
And 3 people, 2 pilots and one of the plane captains, Ron Thomas, was in the back seat of Mike Murphy's airplane.
Okay.
And also the leader, the first leader that we started through winter training with in the first accident was a trail loop accident. He hurt his neck, and so they had to bring in somebody else back as leader, so Don couldn't fly the rest of that season. And then we lost another Phantom in the middle of that year. Oh. And then we've transitioned to the A-4. And then after that, I actually got out of the Navy for a while to try to get my mind right. And worked on the Pro Golf Tour. I caddied on the Pro Golf Tour for about 5 months or so for a guy named Jim Colbert, who's one of my idols, still is.
Really, yeah.
Really, really good guy. And my golf game got a little better, too.
Well, I was going to say, I noticed you're adorned today in a golf outfit, if you will.
Well, we made a trip a couple weeks ago back to, and got one from my favorite course, Navy Marine Golf Course in Hawaii. So
nice.
And then I came back and did another F-8 cruise. While I was on the Blues, after all the accidents, we knew we were going to change airplanes. So they sent each of us to a different airplane to evaluate it for use in the Blues. And they sent me to Cecil to fly the A-7. And Steve Lambert went and flew the A-4. Actually had somebody went and flew the T-2. We weren't going to let him back in if they decided to choose that. But it would have been a good airplane, too. It's just, you make the show around the max of what that airplane can do. And then I wound up, during the war, I actually got a little exchange with the Air Force and flew the F-100 for a little bit. Very little bit. I mean, it was backseat of an F-100D, which is their two-seater, down in Phan Rang in South Vietnam.
And,
We didn't go into Cambodia. You're not seeing me shake my head. Yes, we really did.
Yeah.
And then what else? The last thing I did is I flew the F-14.
The Mighty Tomcat.
Yep. I started, I was in the rag to go to VF 213.
Okay.
And I was out watching the Blues come into town, and a young man killed himself Mike Curtin killed himself at Miramar.
Oh.
And doing rolls. And so they asked me back the next year. So I went back to the Blues a second time in 79 and trained the lead solo. I was the lead solo. I went back and trained Jim Ross, Jungle Jim, who wound up being on the team. Good heavens. I only went twice. I think Jim was there like 4 times.
Okay, hold on. When you say only twice, most guys get one shot out. So how many years did you spend in the blue and yellow uniform?
Three. I did 3.
3 years.
Yeah, Jungle did 4 because they had one other. And it was all accidents or something happened to an airplane or physically to some person on the team. Yeah. A really good friend of mine had a Achilles tendon ruptured. So he couldn't fly, so they had to replace it. And so Jungle had to stay for another year for that.
So when you finish up your first tour in the Blues, did you know that you're kind of on a short list if something happens that can call you back?
No, I never thought of it.
Okay.
We don't. There have been a few, not a bunch, but there have been a few. Vance Parker, who was my opposing solo, was called back before me because of a guy that killed himself in winter training. And then I was called back that time. Then Jungle stayed an extra year, and then they called him back one more time. And I think there might be one more. That they did that to. Been the leaders that have come back.
Yeah.
It's a skill set that you train into.
It's very unique, obviously.
Yeah. And it's kind of hard to replace on short notice.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great aviators out there that can do the exact same job, but to be able to replace it and understand what's going on in short order, sometimes it requires somebody to come back.
Yeah, well said. So what it's hard to tell about Jerry, since he and I just met maybe an hour before this, is his humility. So this guy's been through some crazy experiences, and he's just, you know, you just walk up to him on the street and he's just a friendly guy who would chat with you, and there's no arrogance, not even a bone of arrogance in your body.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
So, okay, so so you got a rich tapestry of naval aviation history, we'll call it. And now we're going to focus in on the F-8.
Okay, okay.
Which is, well, can we call it your first love?
Well, it really was.
Okay.
It really was. You know, starting the F-8 and going into the Phantom after that, that we always had a rivalry at Miramar between the F-4 and the F-8 guys. I mean, it was friendly. It was fun. They were fun to fight. They had an area of flying that they had an advantage. But most dogfights didn't happen in the area of their advantage. You know, down low with thick air, they were great. Mm-hmm. We would drag them up high, and they didn't have a chance. They just didn't have a prayer against us. So, and also, we had different philosophies about it. We used the vertical a lot more than they did. Meaning taking the airplane up.
Yeah.
If you take it up, once it gets slow, you got gravity helping you come back around.
Yeah,
you do a horizontal room. Turn, you know, you just go and go and go and go.
Yeah.
That's why it was fun to fight A7 guys. Because they did. They just put their feet on the instrument panel and pull for all they were worth in a horizontal turn, and you just sit there and just shoot and shoot and shoot. It was fun.
Nice. Well, now, what was the F-4 originally designed to do?
It was an interceptor.
Okay.
It was designed for beyond visual range missile shots, where you didn't have to wrap up. But it was still a very good airplane. When I got in the airplane, transitioned to it from, I was in the rag at Miramar after I came back from the war, and when I was selected for the Blues, I was going to be one of the rag LSOs.
Okay.
And while I was there, I got selected for the team, went back, did some groundwork, then came back to transition to the Phantom,
mm-hmm.
right back to Miramar. And that was the most stable airplane I've ever been in my life. It was... I did my second GCA hands-off. GCA is ground control approach, sorry.
Awesome. That's great.
Yeah, now everybody does ILSs and stuff like that in airplanes, but a GCA was one where they talked you down. Well, once you got that thing stabilized, I took my hands off for the second one all the way till touchdown. I mean, I just did it with the rudders and a little bit with the throttle, and nothing ever happened. The F-8, every correction was three corrections.
And
I pulled the nose up, add the power, or both power, add. It was constantly. Everything was three corrections.
Yeah.
Turning at a lower altitude, I mean, really pulling the airplane, it was always in buffet, but you could feel it really had a great bite into the air. It really could turn.
It's a real good pitch
authority.
Oh,
man, it was fun. And I couldn't figure out how I ever beat this airplane. I mean, at first.
Okay.
And then I got to see what it would do when you get up high and try to do stuff. And I could actually see. And the fact that I would love to have had that airplane against a couple of F-8s, I would have surprised them.
Yeah.
Once you really understand the airplane,
mm-hmm.
And most of the guys there, until Top Gun came to really kind of change some philosophies and change the way that they looked at dogfighting, air-to-air combat, and then they became a very formidable force after that. They really did. And the guys that started it, Dan Patterson and those guys, they did a wonderful, wonderful job.
Nice. If memory serves, and this is obviously, you've got the experience, I just have the internet to research, but about 52, the Navy said, hey, we need a new fighter, and we need a top speed of 1.2. Now, were there many supersonic fighters at that time?
No, I don't. The Air Force probably had one or two, but we didn't have one. I don't think the Demon would.
I don't think so either. So no. In the spec, they asked for 1.2 at 30,000 feet.
Right.
They asked for a climb rate of 25,000 feet per minute, which is very generous, we'll say. But the caveat was that it had to bring it back aboard the boat. And we'll call easier. I don't know if that's the right term to use. So they're looking at like 100 knot approach speed is what they wanted.
Yeah, they didn't come close to that.
Now, how did they try, though, to approach that 100 knot carrier approach speed?
Well, first of all, you have to put flaps on the wing. You have to make the wing bigger so that you can fly slower. Well, when they made the wing bigger in the F-8, you couldn't see the carrier. So it makes it very difficult to come aboard when you can't see where you're going. So their response to that was to lower the fuselage. So everybody talks, well, they raised the wing. Well, they don't. The wing is still the incidence into the wind. It's the same.
Yeah,
they just drop the by raising the wing.
Yeah.
It lowered the fuselage. So you could see, and you still had to really sit up to see it.
Huh.
So a real common tendency in the airplane was to drop your nose.
Okay.
Because you're always looking like this, and you want to see, so you just kind of relax a little
and
bit.
And when you drop your nose on a powered approach.
Yeah, you come down.
The BSI goes
at a time
through the basement.
You don't want to come down.
Yes.
It had a terrible reputation for ramp strikes. I was an LSO in my first squadron, and I saw five ramp strikes in my just my first
five?
Cruise. My
in your first cruise.
Yeah. Starting in the rag, Daryl Eggert coming aboard the boat in CQ. I jumped on the platform to watch him, and he got behind the power curve, and he had full power. And
couldn't recover.
Nighttime, I can still see his eyes right this minute. In the flash of his airplane hitting the ramp with a fireball, and you can see his eyes as it went down the deck.
Did he survive that? He did not.
No, they never found anything.
Oh, my. So, yeah, this thing has been known. Have you ever heard of it called the Ensign Eliminator?
Well, the first, the Ensign Killer, the first one was actually the Cutlass.
Oh, yeah.
The Gutless Cutlass. That was the first Ensign Killer.
Okay.
It probably has been called that. It got better, I think, but other airplanes were worse, I think. The Phantom wasn't. The Phantom was awesome, but it was on a bigger deck, too.
Yeah.
But you just had to be aware. You had to be alert, and the LSOs were, and the guys... You know, everybody looked like deers in the headlights when they got off the deck at night, after a night landing, because it got your attention.
It kept you awake.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it had one of the highest mishap rates. They're saying about 1,200 total in inventory, about 1,100, so it's about 88%, were involved in some type of a mishap.
That's true. It was not that forgiving.
Yeah, exactly right.
Jeez. It really was.
You always had to be on your A game, especially for the night traps, huh?
Oh, yeah. Night traps, and it had a nasty depart... too. Because it had a spin. You had to recover their way from the spin. There were probably a couple of legends that got it out other ways, but you had to do it their way or you weren't going to get out. You had to blow the droops. The droops are the leading edge slats, the front half of the wing.
Yeah.
They come down usually for landing so that it makes the wing bigger once again so you can fly slower. And you had, it's a pneumatic blowing of the droops, and it's a handle over here. You had to grab it and push it down to blow the droops. Well, when you're getting flopped around in that airplane in a pretty violent departure and a spin, it's not the most gentle thing in the world. It's kind of hard to get to that thing. So if you didn't get that out, you weren't going to get out of it probably. Like I said, there was a guy named, absolute legend in the fake community, a guy named Joe Satrapa. Who unfortunately we just lost 2 weeks ago. Joe was, he could do anything with the airplane.
Really?
And he used to do it too.
Just gifted, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, real high voice. Naval Academy guy.
Oh, okay.
Too. Great. God, he was a good guy.
Yeah.
For stories afterwards.
So, okay, fair enough. Yeah.
He's a good guy.
So we talked about the carrier approach. We talked about the high VSI, the sync rates that you really have to be on your A game to overcome, if you will.
Right.
How about on deck? Now, I got this big old low slung intake. Is it kind of hungry out there for flight deck
personnel? It has eaten a few folks, yes.
Okay.
It has.
You ever heard the nickname Gator for that thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what they called it, was the Gator. Everybody knows what the Gator is, and that's what it looks like, too. I mean, that great big old nose and that thing, the big old mouth on it. You know, VF-111 painted shark's teeth. You know, for the things intake, you put shark's teeth in it.
That was very apropos.
And it was low, too. It was just the height. And I've seen it suck things up, but I haven't seen it suck a person up.
Good, okay.
But it's happened more than once.
And then how about even handling qualities on deck? Like the nose wheel steering, was it very good?
It was okay. It wasn't that bad. I mean, it wasn't... one of the problems in 27 Charlies, which is the aircraft carrier that it operated off of mainly, which are the small carriers. They're the Hancock, the Riskany, the Ticonderoga. It's just a much smaller. 27 Charlie is the displacement, is what they...
thank you very much.
100,000, there's a zillion pounds. I don't know.
Something,
the displacement of water, I guess. And it's a small deck. It has it had four wires, but a very small deck, just two cats. You didn't have a waist cat. It's only, I think, 1,000 feet long, 1,100 feet long, whereas the other carriers are significantly longer.
Absolutely.
So when you come aboard, they have to take you up front and do a reverse park so they can get more airplanes in.
Yeah.
Well, he takes you out where you are over the water because you are sitting, the nose gear is behind you, so he has to take it out where it turns. And I mean, in the middle of the night after a night trap, that is not what you want to do. And I've stopped more times than not and just shook him and said, no, I'm not going. I'm not going for a minute. And the guy, okay. And then he'd start again, it was real slow, and then eventually you could do it. But I mean, it's spooky. That part, it was kind of kind of spooky.
Oh, I totally get that. Yeah, and with the Hornet, same thing. So my butt is in front of the nose
gear. There you go. Then you know exactly what I'm
talking about. And those guys with the yellow shirts with the yellow wands at night are taxing you forward. And I would, Jerry, I would honestly just start turning on my own. Like, I wouldn't even shake them off.
We've all done that.
Nope. Yeah. I'm the one getting wet, not you. Yeah, so I'm taking control. So
that's exactly right.
All right, so we talked about some of the pitfalls of the design, right? Mm-hmm. And now, how about some of the advantages or strengths of this aircraft?
Well, it did go fast. It accelerated pretty decently. It actually turned pretty well if you knew how to do it. You had to feel the airplane. I mean, I know.
Let's anchor on that for a little. When you say feel the airplane, mm-hmm. so we're talking buffet. Are there certain cockpit noises? What's a feel for you? Can you tell the listeners? All of those.
Okay. The sound. And as an LSO too. It was the same thing watching them come aboard.
Yeah.
Most of it, you had to look. You could feel the airplane from the ground. You could see when it was getting slow. In the airplane, you could feel it. Your fanny would kind of sink out a little bit. You'd feel the nibble of buffet as you got close to it. Mm-hmm. And you knew how far you could take it into that buffet. And any farther, your turn was actually worse than it was. So you get to the right area in the buffet. You can feel a wing start to go. If it's starting to stall, and you know not to correct it, because the correction is not an aileron, it's a spoiler, and a spoiler gives you even less lift, so you'll be winding out with fire between your legs, fire out the back, fire between your legs, fire out the back. Because I've been that way a few times to know that that's the truth. You can just sense it, the sound of the airplane. You can feel and hear the engine and what it's doing. Mm-hmm. You can tell when it's working. It's a fairly quiet cockpit.
Okay.
It wasn't, you know, really, really loud, but you could still hear wind noises too. So you could hear that too. You knew when it got real quiet that you were really slow.
So all these flight characteristics that aren't quantified by gauges, right? No steam gauge for buffet or... Mm-hmm. Maybe even not looking at angle of attack indications. So do you know how many, roughly how many days, weeks, hours, I don't know, it took you to get comfortable in the F-8?
Different parts of flying. At nighttime, never.
Okay.
Nighttime coming aboard the boat, I was on edge every single time. I never said no, I wouldn't go, but I never really, I might have jumped up a couple times and said, yeah, I want to go. But it was very uncomfortable. I mean, it's just a hard airplane to do. Daytime, even day VFR, you had to be careful around the boat. You just had to. It was an odd feeling coming aboard because you were so close to the boat and it felt so high because we had a 3-degree glide slope instead of the two and a half that most of them are using now. Or 3.5 degrees or 4 degrees.
I think we do 3.5. So we did three. I'm sorry. So you probably did.
It was probably 3.5 to 4 degrees.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
Because it really down. Went down. You know, you come in, you come to break, and you turn in, and you look. Where's the ship? Holy cow! It's down here. You know. So it's a very odd feeling, and at nighttime. You didn't come into the break. You came in straight, but it still, you felt very, very high.
Yeah.
And the tendency was to drop the nose.
And you could have a sink rate, and you got the burble behind the
boat.
Oh,
yeah,
there is
a little burble. Not as big a burble on the 27 Charlie as there was on the bigger boats. Like the Enterprises was terrible, that big square box of an island they used to have. That was a terrible burble. I had friends that flew F-14s there and said they never really noticed it until there. Some guys had... more sensitive butts than me, I guess. They could feel that burble, you know, when it goes. I never really noticed it, to be honest with you. I really didn't.
You were the quintessential LSO with meatball, lineup, angle of attack, right?
And you had to do that. And
the mantra is still good.
A quick story. I can remember one night coming aboard where I was working so hard that night, and the ball didn't move, but then all of a sudden the ball just shot down and then shot off the top, and it scared me so bad. I went to full power, and I'm sitting there, and I'm not going anywhere. Because I trapped.
Oh, and we're talking about the meatball,
the
right?
The Fennell lens. It's got I'm sure most listeners know what that is.
Glide slope indications,
It's a big lens where they take little chunks of it, and so it goes flat, and there's a ball of light, amber light, that you keep between two rows of green datums.
Yeah.
Hold it in the middle, that's the 3.5, 4-degree glide slope. If it's high, you're high. If it's low, you're low. So keeping it in the middle is hard because you have to keep your angle of attack, which is your speed, basically. It's just the way we indicate our airspeed. It takes all the stuff into control and you keep it at 3 o'clock. But you have to do that with your power and with the nose. You drop the nose, you're going to go fast and you're going to go low. So you have to add more power or get the nose up, you know, and you're keeping that thing there.
Yeah.
And then you got lineup. You have to be on lineup because there's not a lot of room out there. I mean, I wish I could remember what it was. It's the same distance to the four wire on a 27 Charlie as it is to the one wire on a big deck.
Oh, okay.
So we've got like 80 feet is all you've got from the ramp to the first wire.
Oof.
And the three wire, they're only 25 feet apart or so. So, you know, 50 more feet. It's not a lot.
No, not at all.
So, you got to be on the center line because there's nothing. It's water on the left side. On the right side, there might be some airplanes and then, you know, then
unforgiving metal.
Yeah, it doesn't dim. So what happened is I'd hit and the nose comes down. So you're flying at an attitude. Okay. And once the main mounts touch down, the nose comes down. I didn't even feel touching down. And all of a sudden the ball goes down because the nose came down because I'd landed. So it went there and then it shoots off the top because you go by it, you know, because you're pulling up.
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't notice the tug. I didn't notice anything. All I noticed is I went to full power and then I realized, oh, this is embarrassing. I'm aboard. It was one of the best passes I've ever flown and didn't even know that it was there.
You get so
into what's going on.
Right? Yeah. Now, the engine at the time, the J57, right?
Yeah, it's a J57 P20, but we had a modification in our, we had the J model of the airplane. When they put the BLC or boundary layer control, it shoots hot air, bleed air out of the engine over the wing so that the air doesn't separate at slow speeds. That air going out there attracts the other air so that you can, in fact, fly slower.
Yeah, have you heard it called blown flaps, I think, is the other...
They may have that
right. BLC is like the big family name for all these high-lift devices.
Yes.
Yeah, and
probably, awesome. Probably so. We didn't use that term when I was flying in that airplane, but it makes perfect sense to me. So by taking that air out of the engine, they had to bleed some of the thrust. So by taking some of that air from the thrust and put it over the BLC, you don't have the thrust coming out the back end, which is excess power if you're in an emergency. So they had to put a bigger engine in. We started having a lot of problems coming aboard. People, you get in a spot, you couldn't get out of it. You were going to hit the ramp. You couldn't do it, and you're still pretty far out. We've had guys go all the way to full power, go into burner, and still hit the ramp from a good distance out.
Did you know an F-35 fighter jet is made up of approximately 50,000 fasteners? High-strength nuts, bolts, washers, rivets, and other aviation-grade fasteners are also used on spacecraft, race cars, and even do-it-yourself projects by hobbyists. If your next project at work or at home calls for mil-spec aerospace hardware, look to D&L Components Incorporated. D&L Components consults space manufacturers, engineering companies, and high-tech startups on hardware availability, application, and alternatives that may lower cost or be more readily available without compromising quality. D&L Components sources alloy steel, A286, titanium, Inco 718, and other Krez materials for bolts, washers, nuts, rivets, Hilox, hydraulic fittings, and more, or they can custom machine when you submit your prints and specs. Go to dnlcomponents.com to learn more and to schedule a consultation with Donnie or Larry. That's dnlcomponents.com.
Wow. Now, that engine, though, I mean, for the time, it was a novel approach to engineering, if you will, because I think it was Leonard Hobbs of United Aircraft Corporation. He and his team, they won the Collier Trophy for that, which is just a prestigious award for aerodynamics, because it was the first 10,000-pound pound force, obviously, jet engine for its time. So it was very new technique at the time. Did you guys have different zones, or did you have incremented afterburner?
No, afterburner was afterburner.
It was on or off?
On or off. You had zones, I think, in the Phantom had zones.
Yeah, and probably the F-14,
perhaps? F-14 did, for sure, okay. But in the F-8, when you went out, you had a little more thrust, but not a lot more. But once you went out, that was...
When you say out, you're talking the throttle?
The throttle, yeah.
Outboard?
Yeah, it goes up, then you go boom, and that's burner.
So it's a very deliberate maneuver.
Yeah, it is a maneuver. It's hard to do it accidentally.
Okay, so even at night, when you're mentioning your spot-on landing, if you will, your okay three-wire, right?
Yeah.
You did not select AB because it's a very intentional maneuver with the throttle.
Now, okay. Now, that it's odd that you would mention that, too. My father was a mechanic in the Navy.
Oh, he
was an AD.
Yeah,
which they had ADRs, ADJs later, but Dad was an AD, an aviation mechanic.
Yeah.
And he was at Pax River.
Okay.
Going through on an airplane called the R3Y, which was a turboprop seaplane. It's gone now, but in fact, it didn't do very well at all. But he going through TPS there, and they while he was there, they trained him on that engine, the Queen Bee, which was the very first B-57.
Oh,
Dad was working on that airplane, and he always told me, he said, "Don't tell anybody, but I dropped it once." So,
he's notorious.
Yes. Yeah. But that was back when the astronauts, John Glenn and those guys there, they were going through TPS at that time when Dad was there.
Which I guess did John Glenn, did he do a transcontinental?
Yes, he did that in an F-8, and I think he did it in a photo airplane, but I'm not certain about that because the photo airplane actually went a little faster. It was
because it was lighter.
No, it was cleaner. Design? It was much cleaner airplane than the others. And I'm pretty sure he did, but I'm not certain. But yes, he did. He went coast to coast in 3 hours or something like that, I think it was. And it was had to tank a couple of times.
So like you said, the thing is fast.
Oh, it is fast.
So per the specs, it's fast. It climbs very well. Now, maybe it wasn't as slow as it should be around the boat. They wanted it 100 knots,
The VLC brought it down. Yeah. That's where we were going with that. And that's why it required an addition to the engine. They gave us an additional 1,700 pounds of thrust. And that's the P-420.
I see.
And that's what we got in the J's. The H, we had the P-20 in it. Then we went to the 420 that gave us that additional thrust. And that was enough to save a lot of lives at the end.
Gotcha.
But the airplane became a day-only fighter because of really poor performance at night around the boat. We were losing too many. We were going around.
Yeah, it's a business decision, right?
It got to the point.
Straight and simple. Yeah.
We still did a few because the CO wanted to do it to prove a point. So I got to go fly with him a few times.
To show him? Yeah. Proof's in the pudding?
Well, show the other guys. Come on, we're going to go flying. Okay, let's go, sir. What'd you give me for?
Oh, I've done that. Yes, I know about that. So I'm going to circle back to the variable angle of incidence. That's going to be where the wing cracks. And I love how you described it as the fuselage drops as opposed to the wing pops up more, if you will.
Yeah.
So when you're going through you come in, so it's day, and you're going to come in over the carrier, perform your brake as you're slowing down. And you roll wings level, I'm assuming you're going to dirty up, so drop the gear and flaps at that point. Is there another switch for the angle of incidence to have the wing break, if you will?
We don't have flaps. We don't lower the flaps. We raise the wing. Drop the fuselage.
Yes, exactly. That's so cool.
It was a handle that came up and looked like a broomstick with a red button on it. You just go outside of a little detent and pull it up. So, and that puts the slats out. What flaps we have came down.
Yeah.
And the wing went up. And you saw all that's holding that thing on there is a tube that's about, an inch and a half in diameter and about 2.5 feet long.
Wow, okay.
And it's not to keep it from pulling off, it's to keep it from pushing down.
Oh.
You have to force it up. It wants to stay down because the center of pressure is in the aft part of the wing, trying to get it to go down.
Oh, absolutely. I totally get that. I would think the opposite intuitively.
There are two guys that lost the wing in the airplane.
Oh.
Neither one of them are with us anymore.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But the wing left the airplane from the aft portion and went forward. That's where the pressure was.
Yeah.
One was in the brake and the other one was flatheading out over the desert over here.
Oh, jeez.
Over the hills on the other side.
Okay. And then when you did activate that, when you broke the wing, you lowered the fuselage.
Good.
I love it. And I think it was up to maybe 7 degrees or something. It was,
quite a bit.
That would be pretty dramatic.
Yeah, it was quite a bit.
Degrees.
That sounds, I don't know the exact number.
Okay, that's fine.
Because I flew it, I didn't build it. So.
And you flew it quite well. But I'm sure you get used to it, kind of like living by the train tracks, you get used to the noise. But when you drop the fuselage, you must perceive it every time.
I'll be honest with you, it felt like lowering the flaps in any other airplane. That's just exactly what it felt like.
Okay.
Now, you had to be cognizant of what was going on. I had a cat shot in Vietnam, fully loaded, which is just, sidewinders and bullets, and full gas, 130 degrees outside, 120 degrees outside.
Oh, yeah, hot.
And it's muggy and you go to a certain speed, and the wing's got to be down by a certain speed. Well, I lowered, raised the fuselage, lowered the wing, and all of a sudden it started really cocking up and going toward the water. So I had to put the wing back up. Even though everything was right, the dense air density was so thin that it just wouldn't work. It just wasn't enough.
And there was never a time that they had a computer that would govern that.
You're talking to the computer.
The soft pink organic interface.
That's the one. The only thing of any computer in that airplane at the time, I'm pretty sure, was the gun sight. There was something in that thing. It was a lead computing gun sight, so that was there. But that was the only computer we had in the airplane.
Wow. So you talked about the wing and unfortunately mm-hmm. the departure of the wings and the loss of some teammates there. Mm-hmm. But I saw a story back in the 60s where out of Naples, there's an F-8 that took off with the wings folded. As in, it actually went weight off wheels, climbed up to 5,000 feet, realized the poor takeoff checklist execution, we'll call it.
And he couldn't see his wing.
And he came back and landed. Have you ever heard about that?
Yeah, it happened in Miramar.
Oh, it did? Oh,
oh yeah. Well, I mean, also, that's happened more than once, yeah. One guy jumped out. He lost control of it, and it went into the houses there at University City. Oh. I don't think anybody was hurt.
Oh, good. Okay. And
I think he got out.
Good.
But, yeah, that's happened a few times.
Sheesh.
But that's sort of on the checklist.
Yeah, well, yeah. But, I mean, just the thing that it's designed, it's such a robust design. It doesn't need its full wing to fly. No. I mean, that's crazy. I'm sure they had to probably jettison the ordnance and dump some gas or something.
If he had any.
The gentleman that stayed with it in Naples.
Yeah, I think it happened at least twice, but maybe even three times. Because I talked to one guy that did it, and I can't remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
I'd keep it to myself anyway.
We'll just call him Bob.
B-A-U-G-H-B. Bob.
So just an amazing piece of engineering feat, I would say, with that. So, okay, we touched a little bit on the armament. So this was indeed the last gunfighter. Is that a true statement?
Well, at that time, yes.
Okay.
The F-18 has guns now, I believe.
Oh, that's a great point. That's a great point. Yes. So what was the main armament, would you say, for the air-to-air arena?
Well, actually, it was a Sidewinder because they didn't get that many kills in Vietnam with the guns. They were there, but we and I used them for strafing a lot.
Okay.
I mean, I did it quite a bit. Matter of fact, the had a lot of missions, did a lot of things over in Vietnam. But the one that sticks in my mind was a close air support mission where we had 27 Marines that were trapped by 200 and some Vietnamese.
Oh,
and they came up screaming for help, and myself and my wingman were in the air. Brian Foy was with me. Was his name? And we checked in. Said, "Yeah, we're here. What can you do?" He said, "Well, I got this." And the guys they're like 80 feet in front of them there, and they're under fire, and when he's talking on the ground, you could hear the guy on the ground talking to the FAC, and you could hear the bullets going off in the background.
So the FAC being the forward air control.
The forward air control, yes,
yep,
I'm
cool.
sorry.
No,
and
cool.
And it was 26 or 27 Marines. And so I said, "Yeah, you got us. We're here. Where are they? You know, we're in market." So,
yeah, how did they mark it?
Well, he put a flare and says, "You go 240 at, you know, 80 feet, and that's the line."
80 feet. Is that danger close? 80 feet.
Yes. And I had to come in, and that's the scaredest I ever was in the war. No matter all the, and I got shot at a lot, and I was in the middle of an awful lot of stuff. I've never been that scared because that's our kids there.
Yeah.
And I had to shoot right. I tried to come down the line as much as I could, but I had to shoot over their heads a couple of times, and I knew one bullet short's going to take our kids out.
Yeah.
My wingman got 3 bullets out in his guns jam. So I wound up with 200 rounds of Mike.
Yeah.
And then I was coming in with the burner, setting trees on fire, whatever I could do to scare them off.
Setting the trees on
whatever
fire.
Whatever was around there, I came in low, tapped the burner, everything
available.
I had. And we got most of them. I got 160 kills. It's what I saw in the message. I didn't keep the message, so.
Okay.
But I think it was 164 KIA. And they ran away.
And our guys
didn't lose a one.
Oh,
didn't lose a one.
That's a blessing.
That is the scariest I ever was in the war.
Yeah,
just because we having to be that close to those kids, and you could hear the fear in their voice on the radio. You could hear it.
Yeah,
and the bullets going off, and it wasn't fear. I mean, it was and not panic, but it was, hey, we got to do something now, or this is going to get ugly.
I mean, when you say 80 feet, that just is stunning because...
It is. I mean, think about it. You know, that house up there.
Yeah, I know. And I wish the listeners could see, but for the folks on the podcast here, so the Hornet, I believe, memory serves, is 44 feet wide. So you're talking less than two Hornet widths are the bad guys.
And I know it sounds unbelievable, but boy, I can still I can see it right now. Some of the passes right now, I can still visualize what was going on.
And you're in an analog plane. I mean, no doubt about it. I mean, sheesh.
And that's where we had to use a grease pencil sometimes.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yep. Booger on the windscreen.
You had to. Absolutely had to. You could put it on the. We had a plate We had a gun sight plate, but we'd put it on that thing on certain ones. And this one I did then.
Yeah, so you would calibrate on deck or?
Well, this time I had to do it in the air.
Okay.
I mean, I knew what it was. And because at the time we had written a lot, bunch of stuff down. It's going to be this for this. But, you know, you change the angle and you kind of have to pull it out of the nether regions and
do that pilot stuff.
You have to do some pilot stuff, yeah.
Yeah, sheesh. Okay, so you got the guns, four of them, 20 millimeter. That was kind of new, right?
Yeah,
they had smaller ones before, and they realized in Korea, I guess, that wasn't.
The spec was for a half-inch bullet, and 20 millimeters, three-quarters of an inch.
So there you go.
Yeah.
So they achieved it.
Yeah.
But did it jam a lot, though? You mentioned your wingman jams.
I've had some jams. I had some jams in air-to-air gunnery practice and stuff like that. I never had it happen to me in combat that I remembered. If so, I'd have been cussing so loud. You'd have heard it. And you hadn't even been born yet, you'd have heard it. And our orties were awesome. It just sometimes it happens. Because we don't actually put all the links on all the bullets. That's done by other people at times.
Okay. And
it didn't happen that much, but it did happen. I've known of it to happen a couple of times.
Okay. You talked about the AIM 9s already.
Mm-hmm.
How about the Mighty Mouse, the rockets?
I never used them. No, they kind of did away with a lot of those at the beginning. I shot Zunis in training.
Okay.
Now, that's a 5-inch sidewinder without guidance. You know,
absolutely, it's
fun to shoot.
I was going
to
say, how exciting is that?
Oh, it was. We shot them out here at the desert in El Centro.
Oh yeah.
And they had a course out there that had trucks and stuff in it, old trucks, and we'd go in there and a FAC would tell us where stuff was, and we get to shoot those. That's the only I shot those about 4 or 5 times, and that was a hoot. I mean, I really enjoyed that. That was fun.
Wow. Have you ever done any night strafing?
Yes, somewhere. I can't remember if it might have been the F-14 I did it in.
Okay.
I didn't do it in the war. Didn't do it in the war at all.
Okay.
But I have done it at times.
I just remember, so with the Hornet, you know, the M61A mm-hmm. is coming out the nose.
Right.
And you get the hot gun gas basically coming
out.
I
love that smell.
Yeah, I love the smell. And also at night with an NVG's night vision goggles on, and you're in a dive and you squeeze the trigger. It's almost like in Star Wars, the Millennium Falcon, where all the stars become these lines.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's kind of...
No, I've done that. I've shot it. Well, another quick story?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
We used to have a thing called BARCAP, Barrier Combat Air Patrol.
Yes.
Where we'd go up and you'd have two F-8s would go up and we'd just fly back and forth. And they could see on their radar, hey, look, you can't get the carrier because you got fighters up here. And that's all it's for. It's just a combat air patrol in case the bad guys come out. We're there to shoot.
So it's almost deterrence.
But you could
employ, obviously.
And we're loaded. I mean, we got two sidewinders and fully loaded with 20 Nightmite. But it's 3 hours long. I mean, it's boring, you know. It's an hour and a half, hour and 45 cycle, I think we did on those things. So it winds up being a 2.5-hour flight, something like that. So you have to tank.
Yeah.
So we get rid of the tank, and we had A4s with buddy stores, and they'd come up to tank. Well, tanking the thing is a little challenging because the thing is behind you. I mean,
So the probe is behind you. So you can't see the tip of the
probe. No. It's back over here behind you. But you set up with a basket, and you put it in the, cut through the windscreen in there. Then you go, you just add a little power and you just drive up the thing and it clunk and you're in and you get some gas. So, and you push it in and it retracts.
Wait, Jerry. So you're telling me that you can't see the probe tip as you're consummating the intercept there?
You can't. It's behind you. I mean, you start doing that, you start fencing with it if you do that.
So it's all canopy gouge.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. You get
cues.
The hose. The hose is constant.
Yeah.
So you just kind of put the hose where it belongs. You know where it is. You set it up out here to start with in front of you.
Okay, yeah.
And then you see where the hose is and just keep the hose there. You know, drive in and keep the hose there. And it kind of goes out a little because of the bow wave.
Yep, right.
But then,
thunk,
you usually get it.
And the bow wave is just because the nose of the jet's pushing the air.
Yeah, it pushes the air away, so it'll kind of move it out
a
little bit.
Yeah.
It's not much, but just enough so you have to...
But once you make contact, will you look over to visually...
No, just... If you see the wiggle in the hose, and you just push it in.
Yeah.
If it goes in,
light?
You know you got it. it's pretty common.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
It's pretty
simple.
Come on, sunshine.
When the light turns green, you get gas.
BARCAP.
No, that's okay.
AR.
And, it's boring. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's a clear night. Okay. So in the Gulf, they have a lot of fishermen out there in what they call banca boats.
Gulf of Tonkin,
I'm
Thank
sorry.
Thank you. That's okay.
And banca boats are just little fishing boats that are maybe 20 feet long, 15 feet long.
Little wooden things with a sail kind of thing?
They've got outboard motors in most of them. I don't think they're sailed. I think they may have that for backup, but I just don't remember that. But it's nighttime. All I know is they have a bow light.
Okay.
And stars.
Uh-oh.
And it's just all one big fishbowl. The lights down there go right in
there's
the
There's no horizon.
There's zero horizons, no moon.
Oh, man.
And so you got a little vertigo to start with anyway.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
So I flew one whole cruise leaning against the canopy, you know, because that's the only thing that was solid in the airplane. But I go in and I missed. And I'm pretty good. I'm not the best in the world. Second
You've
maybe.
Done it a few
Second
times.
Second maybe.
So humble.
And so I backed out, and it's Ziplip. We can't talk.
Yeah,
Ziplip
okay.
means it's radio silence. And so I backed out, and I just clicked. So I'm going to start again. And I started in, and I missed again. So this is not right. So I backed out, and I clicked. I was going in, and I just sat there. And then a little bit later, I saw his rudder kind of go, whoop, so the drogue went away from me. You know, it skidded the airplane, so it took the basket and moved it out away from
me.
So I just lowered down about 5 feet or so, armed the guns, and fired a burst out underneath him.
What? Hey,
one
I'm
burst
back here.
With tracers, and his airplane went, and he went click click. And I didn't have any trouble tanking myself.
So is that the effect of, dare I say, bitch slapping the tanker?
Pretty close. It's a nighttime bitch slap.
With a 20 millimeter cannon.
I saw him in the passageway when we got down. He kind of winked at me and giggled, and I smiled back at him.
But he was never a word was said.
Not a word was said at
home.
He knew. He was a great guy. We had some superb pilots out there.
Oh, well, you have to with that plane. I mean, you do not have the automation we do today.
Oh, no.
There's no.
And the
crush.
A4 is the same way. The A4 was really. It's just as it was actually designed about the same time as the F8 was.
Wow. Sorry, circling back the organs.
Yeah,
how about, no. Yeah, but the bullpup, the AGM-12, did you ever employ that?
Nope, we didn't. I didn't carry it. I never carried it.
And then
the A4s did a lot of those. The bullpup and
they
the,
did? Okay.
Yeah, the walleye and stuff like that. They did some of those.
Gotcha. Okay. Another question. So we went through the strengths and weaknesses, the variants.
Okay.
So just me looking online, looks like about 27 different variants, but a lot of them are prototypes. There's some one-offs, if you will. NASA uses it for, they used it as proof of concept for fly-by-wire.
Yeah.
Right?
That weird wing, they had that slanted wing, forward and aft wing. They did that thing in an F-8.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly right. So
it was done out of Moffett.
Was it? Really? Yep. Just south? San Francisco Bay.
Right.
San Francisco Bay. Very nice. So what variants have you flown in?
Well, in the F-8, the only ones, I've had three. I had the F-8H Hotel. And that was a faster version. Came aboard about 145, 150 knots because it didn't have the boundary layer control in the airplane to slow it down. And I'm thinking it had a different kind of slats in it, too. But, but we had both in the rag.
Okay.
Then the J, the first J, and it was kind of gutless because it had more flaps. And once they put BLC in it, I mean, it was a dog. It was just really slow. I didn't like flying that at all. And then they put the big engine in it, and that gave us almost 1,800 pounds more thrust. That fixed it. That fixed that problem.
Gotcha.
And that was, they all flew pretty much the same, except the H was a little bit more fun in the dogfight, just a little cleaner. So the way you would accelerate when you're ready to get it on is you would bunt the airplane about half a G, make sure the slats are up, and you do that with I hadn't thought about this in 50 years, but you do that by rotating the throttle handle top aft. And that would raise the slats. Do it the other way, the slats would come down.
So slat control's on top of the throttle.
Yes. Now, these are cruise slats, not landing slats. The same mechanism, but one only went down like 2 degrees, and it gave you a little better wing for dogfighting. You got a little more lift. You
dig in a little bit.
Yeah, you could dig in better.
So you
could accelerate like a bandit.
Yeah, you do
that bunt burner, and you'd pick up a lot of speed, and the H did better.
Okay, so when you say fun with a dogfight, which I totally agree, are you more of a two-circle guy in this kind of fight? Is it more of a rate fight, or is it more of a one-circle radius fight?
It's do whatever it takes to kill him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You pass head-on. The way these things, you start about 4 miles apart.
Merge, yeah.
You go by each other, I don't know, 100 feet apart. Oof, you know, yeah. 200 feet, whatever speed you want. It's your, yep. it's your fight. Yeah, yeah. Do whatever you want. And fight's on. As soon as the nose is passed, the fight's on. And you do whatever it takes. And everybody usually would turn into the guy. Well, you keep your eye on him, and you can tell after a while mm-hmm. when he comes into the cockpit to see what his speed is.
And how would you know that?
The airplane just relaxes. You can see it.
So he eases the G.
Yeah, when he's pulling and looking over his shoulder
yep, yep,
at you,
yep, totally.
And all of a sudden he'll come in like this, and he just eases the G a little bit, and you can kind of see the airplane, it just kind of eases. The wing yeah. will come. As soon as he does that, I would reverse, and I'd go down. And the guy come back looking, he couldn't find me.
And, if you lose sight, you lose dead. The fight.
The other half is, you learn if you got too much crossing angle on yeah. the guy, you know, you figure out a way to do something that's not...
Displacement roll, whatever.
Displacement,
yeah.
High yeah. yo-yo, low yo-yo, whatever
yeah.
it takes.
Yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
meaning you pull the nose up and it looks like, you know, a little up and down type thing. And
yeah.
Or you do a displacement barrel roll away, whatever it takes. Just
yeah.
ease and know when it's time to leave. Use
yes.
as an escape maneuver, too, to haul ass... Pardon my French.
Out of
dodge. You want to get,
totally
get away from
out,
it
right?
to come back in again.
Yeah.
And maybe get some advantage. Unexpected is what you want to be. And I was pretty decent. I didn't really know what I was going to do at the time.
Wow, Jerry. So I don't want to stop you, but I got a couple more questions just want to roll through. So notoriety of the F-8. Mm-hmm. So tell me, Cuban Missile Crisis. Let's rewind to about 62, right? The
mm-hmm.
early 60s anyway. Do you know anything about that?
I remember when it happened. I was in high school. I was a senior in high school. I graduated in 63. So when that did happen, I know that the Russians were sending, had already positioned missiles in Cuba.
Okay.
Kennedy says that's not going to happen. So we started to blockade some stuff, and we wanted to prove it. So what they wound up doing was sending a whole bunch of airplanes down to Key West and
yes.
into Florida.
Okay.
And to prove it, they sent a couple of pilots or two airplanes from, I think it was VFP 63, but it could have been VFP 62.
You're yes and yes. You're
okay,
correct.
Good.
Spot on.
And what they did is they went in on a normal photo run, which is the same as the photo runs that we had.
Which are we talking U2 high altitude?
Oh,
kind
no,
of
no.
Stuff?
We're talking in on the deck.
We're talking like dragging
feet.
Your nuts across
yeah,
the ground.
Yeah, yes, 1,000 feet, 500 feet. You come in below the radar, they don't see you coming.
Yeah.
Can't hear you because they come really fast.
Okay.
You know, you're already gone by before they know you're there. They know where they're going. No, they didn't have GPS or any of that stuff. This is a little before that. But they. We knew how to DR. We knew how to look at the
DR.
Ground. Direct reckoning. You knew how to find your way in the company. I've got a couple stories on that as well. During Vietnam, when I had to do the same sort of thing. Not as good as what these guys did, but the
okay.
same sort of thing. And they just went in. They found the target that they were supposed to get, and they took thousands of photos. And they're all taken with a big old camera on the side of the F-8. They've got camera on the front, and they got cameras on the side.
Okay.
And, they took some fire, but not much, if I'm remembering right. No air to surface to air missiles, I don't believe, but
okay.
a lot of ground fire, 37 millimeter, and most of it's the Russians, you know, 37 and 57. I don't think they had any 103s or whatever that one was.
Oh, the bigger ones?
Yeah. And then they got out, and I think they went back to Key West, is what I think they did.
I believe Jacksonville, Florida.
They got up to Jacks.
Yeah.
They may have tanked and got all the way to Jacks.
Yeah, I think so.
And what they did is they turned them right around and sent them to D.C. They didn't trust them to take that stuff out. They wanted to get this stuff to the Pentagon right away.
Yeah.
I want to say the guy's name was Coffee, was one of the pilots, and I couldn't find it this morning.
Okay.
But I had dinner with him. People that lived up the hill from me here in town were friends with his. And we made very good friends with them later on in our life. We'd been in our house for 20 years before we ever met him, and they lived four doors away.
Huh.
But he was
really? Yeah.
The guy was a World War II Thunderbolt pilot. And, wanted to be in the military, attaché to Paris, and another story, another lifetime. He saw me getting a little trouble there. But he had this guy over for dinner, and he was very humble, fun to talk to, being another F-8 guy.
Oh, yeah, totally, right?
And Bill, the guy that invited us to dinner, was having a ball just sitting and listening to the story. So. But he had more stories than me. I mean, it was a different time, but boy, was it fun to listen to.
So I guess I think the whole mission set, we'll call it, lasted 6 weeks. And during those 6 weeks, they produced over 160,000 images that was sent up to D.C. to check on the Russians and their implementation.
Exactly. And that gave gave us the proof that they actually were doing what we said they were doing, and they denied.
And and then they flinched, and the rest is history.
That's exactly right.
Do you know anything about a stencil of a dead chicken on the side of the RFA?
I had heard about that, but no. Okay. I guess
that was a significance because it was like the mission accomplishment. So instead of shooting down somebody and stamping that kind of plane on underneath the canopy, they would stencil a dead chicken.
Now, I had not heard that. I think I read that recently, but I did not know that.
So, and then I believe all those pilots that did that, those two sortie goes a day, right? The section goes, a day. They all got Distinguished Flying Crosses.
Yeah, I saw they got the DFC for that. And they deserved that. They did a really good job. They really, really did a good job. And they did it well. And it wasn't that easy to do. I was on several photo escorts because all the photos, missions in Vietnam, the photo pilots didn't go alone. They always went with one or with just another fighter. I was trying to think it was two, but it wasn't. It was just the photo pilot and me one of the other guys in the squad.
Yeah. Now, I got to ask, and I know you're very humble. I can tell immediately but do you happen to have any medals?
I never got a DFC.
No, but just any kind of...
I have several. I've got several air medals and individual strike, not just strike flight. If you got 14 points or 21 points or something, you got one air medal.
Yes.
And I wound up with, I don't know, 20 of those. but then I got several other air medals for individual action.
Okay, yeah.
My DFCs were all downgraded to plain captain of the month, so...
it's all good. Oh, man. So, and then circling back to Vietnam. So the kill ratio is 19 to 3.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned earlier very few were gun kills. I think only about four.
I believe it was four what I remembered.
Sidewinder employment.
Yeah, and it was all, early on it was the Bravo, which was a really bad AIM-9. AIM-9 is the Sidewinder.
Yes.
And the Bravo was the early ones. The Delta, which is the ones we carried mainly while I was there. That's all we carried. They had some Charlies, which was actually a radar sidewinder.
Really?
Yeah, and the F-8 was one of the few that used it. I had a guy that was our ops officer, our maintenance officer at the time, and ops officer as well during the war, Boyd Repture. Boyd actually shot some of those things. And he said, oh, they're okay. Didn't hit much. It was, it was same size, 5-inch round. It had a very, very early radar for guidance on it, and we controlled it in the airplane. We had a radar scope in it.
So it's semi-active. It uses the radar energy from the plane, bounces off the target, and it receives that and goes toward the...
I never shot one, and we really weren't trained on it, so I don't know that much about the real intricacies of it.
Okay.
Just know it's in our book, and they never had any on the ship or never had any two shoots, so we didn't get to. Shot a lot of Ds, and I think I shot one or two Mikes later in the F-14.
So now, 19-3, you obviously contributed to that, and you are the only guy that didn't have to squeeze a trigger at all.
Paul Harvey. I don't know if you know who Paul Harvey is.
The rest of the story.
That's it. My grandmother heard it in Caldwell, Idaho, where he talked about my MIG scare. And, and his comment was, it was the most cost-effective kill of the war.
You're the most efficient warfighter I have ever met.
Right. You know, I may be thin, but I've got a really nasty grimace.
scary indeed.
I had heard they had a get-together on the Midway last year or year before last where they brought the guys that were involved in MIG kills and shoot-downs of U.S. airplanes to the Midway, and the guys that were involved here shooting those guys down, and they got together in a symposium on the Midway and someplace else in town. I unfortunately... I have a job and I was caught out of town and I missed it.
Okay.
But I was told that the guy that I scared down was there, but they come up with a name, had his name, and I looked it up and he's a doctor now. So a doctor.
He survived
and he was a doctor in North Vietnam. So
doing good things for his country.
Yeah, so I'm proud of him. If that in fact is the truth, I'm very, very proud of him and glad I didn't shoot.
Yeah. It worked out. Now, I've been calling you Jerry the whole time, and I didn't even introduce you by your call sign. So
you did it at the beginning.
Did I throw it out there? Okay. So is there any story to Turkey?
Well, as you know, with your call sign of Sunshine, I'm sure I can, having met you for the first time, I know where it came from. But the yes, you don't choose a call sign. You are awarded a call sign.
Exactly.
when I was in the RAG, the replacement air group at Miramar, we'd do dogfighting, and what you do, the first one back usually wins. Well, I would come back, and I would draw the fight up on the board with an airplane getting shot at by. To back up just a little bit, I thought since my last name is Tucker, Fryer mm-hmm. would be a good call.
Oh, Fryer Tuck. It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, it sounded like it would work. Yeah. So I had an F-8 really pulling really hard with contrails coming off the wingtips and a frying chicken in a frying pan.
Oh, okay.
Shooting him down.
Fryer. Okay.
Fryer.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
Well, the guy I was fighting against was Rick Phillips. Okay. Barfly was his call sign. You can decide where that one came
great
from.
One.
He came in and he looked up and we just got back from the tactics op and I'd shot him. And he looked at that and he said, you know, that's not a fryer. That's a turkey.
Oh.
And
yep.
It stuck.
And that was it? That's all it took?
That's all it took.
And if you show any resistance.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Yep. I tried not to. But
exactly.
But no. It stuck, so I wound up being Turkey from then on. And now people, I still get my emails from my really good friends from back then. Everybody
and you're
calls.
Just Turkey.
Yeah,
everybody. They may not even know your first name.
Some don't. You know? Some really don't. I've gotten mail addressed Jerry Turkey.
Jerry Turkey.
Yeah.
Tucker Turkey, potato, yeah, potato.
There you go. That's exactly right.
As long as I got the street address right.
So. That's right. I still get it.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Turkey.
It's been my pleasure.
It's been my pleasure and my honor. So.
Oh, thank you.
And I just love that you're almost a neighbor.
That's
you know
right.
What I'm saying?
Yeah, you are.
It's a great place to live, I'll
Good.
Say that.
Thank
so,
you. Thanks,
thank
thanks
you
for
very
your work.
Much. Oh, yes, sir. Yeah, that's cool. Wow.
All right, Sunshine. Wow. You and I have diverse backgrounds, but Turkey, we can't hold a candle to this guy.
No, he takes the cake, man.
Totally agree.
All right. Yeah, so let me get this straight. A4, F4, yep. F8, mm-hmm. F100, although he says he didn't fly it very much. He was a landing signal officer. Mm-hmm. He was a Blue Angel, not once, but twice.
Twice, dude.
A pro tour golf caddy. Are you kidding me? Holy smokes. And then a captain at Southwest for the longest time. Amazing.
Oh, amazing, Jill. I'll tell you what. I'm waiting for the book to come out, to be honest with you. So he's he's a very humble dude. But yeah, he was a great interview. Just a great all-around guy. Someone you'd love to go share a beer with and just hear more and more sea stories.
Well, we can maybe do that figuratively. This guy's local, you said, right?
He is, indeed.
Well, to our earlier point about answering questions maybe with a third party, we should grab him and do a Facebook Live session because I have to think he could keep people riveted.
He keeps me riveted, and I would love the Facebook Live, and I may even be jealous or selfish and not let the folks ask questions. I may do all the asking.
Well, maybe we can sneak one in there. Well, at any rate, when we edited this interview, and I hated to do it, but it was a great long discussion and sounds like we got through all the different, what does it do and what's it good at and all the variants and all that, but there was so much more and we did chop some of that out and we will make that available on Patreon for our show supporters. As part of that support, they gain access to exclusive content. So if you want to check that out, head on over to patreon.com and look for the Fighter Pilot Podcast. And we'll add any new terms to our glossary on the website, as we always do, fighterpilotpodcast.com. But Sunshine, there was two things I wanted you to articulate or explain a little further for us. First off, you guys said ensign killer. Now, what does that mean? How is an airplane an ensign killer?
Yeah, so back in the day there, ensign would be the first rank in the Navy, right? So sometimes flight school can be so accelerated, especially during wartime. The guys will finish, they'll get commissioned, finish flight school, get their wings, and become an ensign. And then that's when they're green, and that's when they know just enough to be dangerous. So this plane apparently was a little unwieldy, specifically for takeoffs and landings. And so the new guys, it was kind of trial by fire, or what I'd call Darwinism.
Okay, so an ensign is a rank, and then the equivalent is, let's say, a second lieutenant in the Army, Air Force, or Marine Corps.
Absolutely.
Okay, but the first rank you have is an officer in the Navy and what? The Coast Guard, and I think even in the Star Trek series, maybe. I don't know. I think they used our ranks. Was
probably.
Ensign. Okay. And, dude, I have to challenge you on this. 88% of all F-8 Crusaders were involved in some sort of mishap. Are you kidding me?
Crazy. Yeah. Now, we're considering a mishap as an operational loss, so not a combat loss. And truth be told, Jello, we actually rounded the number up. It's 87.7, so we rounded up to 88. But so basically, 1,261 airframes rolled off the assembly line, of which 1,106 were involved in operational mishaps. So just around the boat or just during normal flight administration, if you will. And that number
Holy
there
smokes.
Is 87.7, which rounds up to 88. They only lost 3 in combat. And going back to the operational losses and kind of the idea of the ensign killer, so there were a few design flaws that they did add some patchwork to, if you will, to fix. There was a directional instability. That would be the yaw stuff. So kind of yawing back and forth. And they're going to add some ventral fins, which will help that out. But there's also an additional longitudinal instability, especially during takeoffs and landings. So we could talk about over-rotation or stalling out the aircraft. So these would be big pitfalls, obviously, with the aircraft, lending itself further to the name Ensign Killer.
Okay.
Yeah, now that variable incidence wing, the thing that breaks, you know, so you can get a higher alpha, which is a slower right. approach speed. Well, if the mechanism was damaged for the variable incidence wing, then these guys would have to come in at over 200 knots so that they don't scrape the tail on the runway.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Coming at 200 knots because their tire speed was not much above that. So you're really painting yourself into a very small corner trying to get back aboard or trying to land at the beach. So, and then finally, specific to flight deck performance, the nose gear was positioned well aft of the pilot. So he had trouble just kind of with a human factor side of trying to understand the dynamics of the turn. It took a little bit of getting used to how to turn this thing. And there's not a lot of room for error, as you know, on the flight deck when you're taxiing right. around.
Right. No, you guys did talk about that. And I can't recall if that ended up in this interview or if we cut that for Patreon. But either way, yeah, that was an interesting story about where the nose wheel is. And in a lot of different aircraft, you have to figure that out. Even in my airline capacity now, you have to take turns a little wide. But wow, that is crazy. I did not know that about the F-8. And especially that the angle of incidence, effectively what you're telling me is by lowering the fuselage, as you put it in the interview, you're saving about 60 knots because if you don't get to do that and you come in at 200, but your approach speed is about 140, well, then that yep. is quite a significant aerodynamic factor. That's crazy.
It is. Yeah, things are coming at you a lot more quickly. Your VSI mm-hmm. can drop real quickly out from underneath you and just, could lead to a bad okay. situation. So, hey, Jello, you had also mentioned Patreon. So, hey, what's going on with Patreon these days?
Well, because we haven't really announced them lately, we've got a bunch of new Patreon supporters. We're always so thankful for them. For division leads, we have Kevin Killoran, Connor Bowden, Colin Lamb, Lisa Davis, Anthony Delgado, Colin Smith, and Wada Al-Talji. Now, do you want to cover our mission commanders?
Yeah, our new mission commanders are Mark Avant, Jacob Walker, Bob Wakefield, and Brad Fisher.
Yep, and Brad and I just did our 30-minute phone debrief earlier today, one of the perks of the mission commander, as well as the air boss, and we do have one new one of those, and that is William Kwan. Well, we are always very thankful for the support of our patrons, and so again, head on over to patreon.com and check that out if you're interested in supporting the show and gaining access to exclusive content. Well, Sunshine, this is the part of the show we always like to remind everyone that the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of the hosts and our guest and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components. Now, Sunshine, this is the Fighter Pilot Podcast, but we talk about all military aviation. So 2 weeks from today, we're going to be back. And guess what? We're going to look at a 1960s era spy plane that still holds numerous speed and altitude world records. Now, don't give it away, but do you have an airplane in mind?
I do. And let's just say that the slide rule, not the computer, was instrumental in the design of that aircraft. And just like you said, it still is an amazing aircraft.
It certainly is. You see a lot of them on display at different museums, but we'll find out all about that with a guest in 2 weeks who can tell us not just about flying it, but also about the speed of it, especially compared to other aircraft,
nice.
Notably an F-18. So
Ooh.
Anyway, we'll cover that another time. But until then, what else we got, Sunshine?
I think that's about it, Jello. What do we always say?
I think we should get out of here.
All right. See you.
You've been listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, brought to you by BVR Productions. Got a question for the show? Send an email to questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com or leave a message on our listener line, 877-MACH-101. That's 877-622-4101. Be sure to check out our website at fighterpilotpodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. For exclusive Fighter Pilot Podcast content, check out our Patreon page. Please like, follow, and subscribe to the show. And don't forget, share us with your network. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.